Recently, President Obama unveiled an expansive research initiative intended to redefine how we understand the human brain. This hour, understanding what can go wrong with the brain. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we talk brain science with Daniel Trinnell. He's director of the Iowa Neurological Patient Registry. That's a unique Iowa registry that tracks patients who've experienced brain damage. Then in the second half hour, we talk with brain trauma survivor, now rehabilitation advocate, his wife, and a brain therapy manager. That's coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in April, you might remember, President Obama unveiled an expansive research initiative intended to redefine how we understand the human brain. And with that in mind, as a backdrop, this hour we want to focus on brain trauma. Now, while the cause of a traumatic brain injury, say a car wreck, a fall down stairs, a concussion on the football or soccer field, is often known, the next steps in the treatment process and the predictions of a patient's future are not always clear. In 1982, the Iowa Neurological Patient Registry was established. My guest, Daniel Trinnell, was a graduate student when that registry started. He's been with the program for its entire history and assumed the role of its director in 2005. Daniel Trinnell is currently professor of neurology and psychology at the University of Iowa, and as I just mentioned, current director of the Iowa Neurological Patient Registry. He joins us for the first half hour today. Professor Trinnell, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Happy to be here.
So tell me a little bit about the spectrum of brain damage in the registry.
Well, we've actually focused on some specific types of brain damage. The main one is stroke. We've also studied brain infections and surgical treatments where surgeons take out a piece of brain tissue for the treatment of epilepsy or for the removal of a tumor or that type of thing. Mm-hmm. The reasons we focused on those types of neurological conditions are because one of the primary goals of the resource is to study how specific functions are related to specific brain structures. And in order to do that, we need patients who have lesions or damage in their brain that's very well delineated and very localizable. So we need what we call a focal lesion, a focal area of damage. Mm-hmm.
Do you and your colleagues also keep up relationships with these patients?
We do, yes.
Mm-hmm. And they're all living patients?
Well, the registry is a dynamic entity, so the patients are not all of these thousands of patients we've enrolled are living at this point. Patients grow old and die, and they can develop disqualifying conditions whereby we don't study them any longer. So it's a dynamic entity that requires continued maintenance. Whereby we're continually recruiting new people to come into the registry and participate in our research program. Mm-hmm. That effort requires an infrastructure, a research team that we have at the University of Iowa that's largely responsible for this recruitment and the maintenance of the patient registry.
Mm-hmm. Having those patients come in and having a relationship with a patient going back, well, you have patients that you've known for what, decades?
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
How does that make this registry unique and more valuable?
Well, first of all, there's no registry like this that I know of on the face of the earth, and it's become a very valuable scientific resource. The scope of it and the type of patients we have enrolled in it make it unique as a scientific resource. And the fact that we've been at this for, more than three decades at this point also makes it quite unique. I've literally grown old with some of my patients. I began studying these people when I was still a graduate student, as you mentioned. We started this in 1982. And many of the patients we enrolled in those early years are still in the registry, still alive and well, still come back for research studies, and we have literally grown old together.
Mm-hmm.
That creates some very, also some very powerful opportunities to study the interaction of brain injury and the aging process. And there's, again, nothing like this on the face of the earth in terms of a scientific and clinical research opportunity.
So not only how certain types of brain damage affect the brain, but how these brain damages then grow old and develop over time.
Correct. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Since the mid-1990s, something called functional magnetic resonance imaging has developed into a highly popular research tool, commonly known as fMRI. It detects brain activity during cognitive tasks. This is the lighting up of certain brain parts that we're familiar with when we see it. I wonder how that imaging fits in with the work that you've done on with these individual cases in the registry.
Great question. That imaging approach, functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, is a complementary technique. So that's typically done in normal individuals to study how a particular cognitive task activates particular brain areas. And it complements our method by showing areas of activation under normal task performance, whereas our approach studies what we call a lesion deficit model, which is looking for a problem with a function in the setting of damage to a particular brain region.
Mm-hmm. So do you use image to look at damaged brains functioning?
We use the imaging primarily as a way to map the structural damage in the brain, and we do that at a very precise level, so we know exactly what areas of the brain are damaged.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a challenge because, like any body part, the brain is very different from one person to the next. Even identical twins have very different brains when you get down to the details.
Oh, really? How far do you have to go down to differences in what way, though?
Well, it's you know, a 30,000-foot view of human brains. I mean, if I put 10 on a table and had you just look at them sort of at a cursory glance, they would look pretty similar, just like feet would or hands would. If you look at them a little closer, you'll notice that the cracks and the bumps are a little different. And if you look at them even more closely, you'll notice, you know, no two are alike, just like two hands or two feet or any body parts across different people.
Mm-hmm.
So this creates a challenge because we have to account for differences across individuals in the brain structure. And when we're comparing many individuals and the area of damage in their brain, we have to be sophisticated in taking into account different landmarks and making sure that our anatomical analysis is accurate.
So when we talk about functional magnetic resonance imaging and we see different parts of brains lighting up, does that tell us really how the brain functions? In terms of correlations, what happens when we think about certain things, do certain activities?
So we talked about how this technique is complementary to the technique that we use with our patients. The technique is, you know, it has a transparency and a sort of a superficial logic that's appealing because you have some task like eating chocolate or voting for a Democrat that, you know, purportedly lights up a particular brain area, and then you can draw some conclusion about the relationship. But in fact, the logical limitation of the technique is that it's pure correlation. It means simply that these two things are related, not that one causes the other. Another factor is that for virtually any complex task, many, many, many brain areas light up. What researchers report are usually ones that they can make sense out of and that make a good story, and they put some table in the back of the paper with the other 10 or 50 or 100 brain areas that also light it up during the activity. Now, contrast that with our method whereby you put a hole in somebody's brain and they can't do something. I have a patient with two focal holes in her brain who can no longer experience fear, or a patient with one focal hole in her brain who can no longer recognize familiar faces. The logical power of a conclusion there is much stronger. When that brain area is damaged and the person loses a function in its entirety, you have a much stronger conclusion.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Professor Daniel Trunell, of the University of Iowa, Professor of Neurology and Psychology, current director of the Iowa Neurological Patient Registry. It's a one-of-a-kind registry that collects multiple instances of patients who have experienced brain damage as a result of many different types of things, injury, illness, surgery, and helps researchers understand our brain. You talked about brain higher function is what you're interested in the brain. The brain does a lot of things, but you're focusing on higher function. We still have a lot of open questions in terms of higher function. We hear in our news that we're understanding how the brain might steer us toward a specific religious persuasion or political orientation. What can you say about those areas of higher function that we know from science?
Well, I would say that in regard to things like religious persuasion or political orientation, we probably don't really know too much about the specific brain areas that are important for those. And that's true despite what you might hear in the news about a study purportedly found the brain area for being a Republican or a Democrat or whatever. But we have made a lot of progress in understanding brain areas and brain circuits that are very critical for complex functions such as decision making, choosing among alternatives that are very close and where it's difficult to decide what exactly is the best answer or the best path forward. That kind of a decision is difficult and doesn't always have an obvious right answer. And making that kind of a decision is something that our brains do on a regular basis. And we've made a lot of headway in understanding the neurological basis of that.
Uh-huh. Was that a fundamental shift in our understanding of decision making, or sort of incremental? Is there an old way of understanding decisions compared to the newer way, for instance?
I think the answer is both. There's been incremental advances in understanding decision-making. And then I would cite a breakthrough that was made here at the University of Iowa based on studying these patients in our registry in the mid to late 1980s, where we began to appreciate the importance of emotion for making good decisions. This led to the development of a very influential theoretical framework called the somatic marker hypothesis, developed by Antonio Damasio. And we've done numerous empirical studies based on that theory, showing that emotion is a critical part of the decision-making process. And it's created a real paradigm shift because it suggested that having too little emotion is just as bad for decision making as having too much emotion can obviously be.
So, to take an example that comes to mind, when someone's angry, they make a decision. We can easily understand they often make a poor decision.
Correct.
And then the other side of that is when they're just so passive about the outcome that they don't put enough brain energy into it.
Yeah, it's a matter of emotions providing guideposts, gut feelings, signs that steer us in an advantageous direction when making decisions.
Mm-hmm. So having a gut feeling doesn't only have to do with your gut. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. That's right. It has to do with our brain and how our brain is reading signals from our body to help us make decisions, uh-huh. Emotional signals.
Uh-huh. Can you tell me anything more about having a gut feeling about a decision you should make?
Sure. The gut feelings are something that, you know, you can call them hunches. People make decisions that may not even be at the level of their conscious awareness. And they base that on, you know, signals from their body. And we can call those emotional signals. And we know now from our research that when those signals are missing, decision-making can be disrupted and can be dysfunctional.
I mentioned at the beginning of this that President Obama's had a brain initiative that was launched earlier this year. Will that initiative affect brain research here in Iowa at all?
Well, we hope that it will. We have already formed a working group here of scientists, neuroscientists at the University of Iowa, who are interested in taking advantage of this, if possible. You know, the immediate goal would be to leverage some of the unique strengths of our institution, our university, our state, our population base, to address some of the, you know, agenda that's provided in Obama's roadmap.
When you say leverage our population and our state, what advantages? How do you leverage Iowa and our population?
Well, you know, with things like our patient registry. In fact, when we actually had a meeting planned out that got derailed by an Iowa blizzard a couple months ago. Hard to think of blizzards when we're sitting here in the middle of a flood in the summer again. But anyway, we had a meeting planned out where we were going to present some of these institutional strengths to a visitor from Washington who was going to talk to us about, you know, research opportunities related to Obama's initiative. And, you know, we're talking about things like our patient registry, things that are unique to Iowa or particular strengths of Iowa. We have a relatively homogeneous population. We have a well-educated population. We have a population that's very loyal to the University of Iowa in terms of participating in research projects. We have a stable population. People are, you know, relatively easy to find. When you call them 4 years later, they still answer the same phone. And all of these things contribute to, you know, being able to study human beings with the types of research projects that we have, and make, you know, real path-breaking discoveries in understanding higher brain functions.
So, when we talk about brain research, what has it brought us to date? When we talk about millions, more than millions invested in brain research, where has it taken us?
So after the decade of the brain ended, we looked at what we had accomplished in brain science, and what we had accomplished was learning a tremendous amount about how the brain works and how neurons talk to each other and all kinds of information about how things work. We had no breakthroughs in terms of curing brain disease. We had no cures and no preventions. We have no preventions for the most common and, you know, horrible conditions like Alzheimer's disease. So the NIH at that point decided going forward that they would put a burden on scientists to have a more justification for the impact of their work. And if we're gonna give you $1 million to do research, tell us how it's gonna be directly relevant to patient health and disease.
Less theoretical, more practical, relevant to the population.
Yep, correct. And this skews the scientific process because a lot of breakthroughs are not based on planful things where, you know, the goal in the first place was to discover the answer. You know, the light bulb wasn't discovered by incremental improvements on the candle.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Completely different.
Yeah, it's just a complete breakthrough out of the blue, and you need basic science. And I'm saying all of this because we have a research operation. As you mentioned, we've been at this for more than three decades at the University of Iowa that's been funded by NIH for a long time. But that funding is now in jeopardy because of this increased emphasis on direct relevance to, you know, patient health and so forth. And that funding is harder to come by, and the entire resource is in jeopardy because of that.
I wonder, to finish up here today, if I ask you this question. If we had, Professor Trinnell, a pie chart showing how much we understand the brain compared to how much we don't understand, what would that look like in your estimation? You're smiling. Is that a hard question?
It's a hard question. It depends on the level you, you address that question. I mean, compared to 100 years ago, in terms of sort of broad brain behavior relationships, you know, we could color in a large majority of the pie as now we understand it. You know, we didn't used to. And there's a minority left to understand. If you took the perspective or the level of analysis of the, you know, do we understand the neural mechanisms, the way that brain cells talk to each other, that are at the bottom of all of these complex functions, then we're probably looking at coloring in a sliver of that pie.
Really, a thin sliver.
As this is what we know for sure, and the rest is what remains to be understood by science.
We hear a lot about brain health in the news. What do you think are the most important practices for a healthy brain into old age? What do you do, with your knowledge, to keep your brain healthy? First and foremost.
Yeah, there are probably three parts to the answer to that question. One is your genes, which you can't do much about. Good genes are a good thing to have. Genes is one thing. That's, you're kind of stuck with what you've got there. A second factor is sort of nutrition and, related to that, not feeding toxins to your brain. Those are very important. So that's kind of in the category of, nutrition and staying away from bad things, drugs and alcohol being the most obvious examples of bad things.
So no alcohol, for instance.
Well, it doesn't need to be none. It needs to be, not very much. Alcohol is a neurotoxin, and too much of it is bad for your brain.
Okay.
And then the third thing is exercise, just general physical well-being. Exercise is good for your brain. It's been shown to influence your brain health and your brain function, so that your brain functions better when it gets regular exercise.
Mm-hmm. You left out brain puzzles, crossword puzzles. That's not in there anywhere?
Yeah, well, we could put that under exercise. You want to exercise your brain as well as your body. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Daniel Trinnell, Professor of Neurology and Psychology at the University of Iowa, the current director of the Iowa Neurological Patient Registry. It's been a pleasure having you today.
My pleasure, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Coming up in just a moment, we talk with a brain trauma survivor who is now a rehabilitation advocate, his wife, and a brain therapy manager. That's after a short break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Has someone in your family suffered from a brain injury? Once every 23 seconds, it's estimated, someone in the U.S. experiences a traumatic brain injury. 1.5 million Americans survive traumatic brain injuries each year. Over 3.5 million Americans live with disability from traumatic brain injury. And those are not even statistics including the number of persons who have experienced a concussion, the most common form of a brain injury. Here in Iowa, if we focus on the state, over 2,500 people experience a traumatic brain injury each year. That boils down to once every 2 hours. Over 50,000 Iowans live with the consequences of brain injury. We want to talk about this in our next half hour. Joining me now, a man who has lived with a brain injury for the past 4 years. Mark Block is in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
Great to have you with us. Your wife, Carla, is with us as well. Hi, Carla.
Hi.
Great to have you come into the studio. Mark, let's have you start off by telling us how you incurred a brain injury 4 years ago.
Well, as you mentioned, 4 years ago, I was working my driveway, as I customarily did. I worked out of my home and traveled during the week and then reloaded my vehicle with information on the weekends. And I was picking up a box of information to carry to my van, and I tripped. As I picked up one box and I turned, I tripped over the other box, and I fell into my wife's van, torpedoed the side of her car, and fell to the ground and had a tremendous excruciating pain in my shoulder that radiated down into my hand. And
so you were not knocked out there?
I don't know, to be quite honest. I was by myself. I remember having this sensation. You know, I saw the bright lights that often come with the blunt trauma. But you know, and next thing I know, I was on the ground, and I got back up and tried to collect myself. So I don't know whether I was or not.
What sort of symptoms did you have, Mark, aside from the ones you've described in the near term, and then did they change?
Well, actually, I was able to gather myself and get up, and I went and sat down in my vehicle and thought, you know, it was just kind of like a zinger. I thought that might pass, but as time went on, I got an increasingly pounding headache, but I also started to get increased spasticity to the point where my left arm was almost completely cramped and I couldn't put it down.
Spasticity meaning cramps or just uncontrolled movement? Or
Very tight cramps, cramps, almost to the point where it was debilitating. And then as I continued to wait for it to pass, I actually decided that it would be best if I went to the hospital. So I actually ended up driving myself to the hospital. And by the time I got to the hospital in the parking lot, I was almost like I was shaking bilaterally, almost like I was having seizures.
Wow. So you get looked at the hospital, their diagnosis?
Well, their diagnosis initially was a spinal cord injury. And they did a CAT scan and MRI. And while I was being treated for a spinal cord injury, and that responded very favorably. But I continue to have these symptoms of nausea and vomiting and confusion and almost elation. And I mentioned to my wife I was watching TV in the hospital, but the TV wasn't on. And I had called her a couple of times, and I didn't remember calling her. And I called her again, and had these mood swings. And jumping forward, when I got out of the hospital, I came home. I had all these increased sensitivity to light, and when the doorbell would ring and the dog would bark, I'd get extremely agitated and irritable, and had problems sleeping. And
when you shared these other symptoms with the doctors, did they say they were consistent with spinal cord injury or something else?
Well, they said I have a condition called autonomic dysreflexia, which is a side effect of the spinal cord injury, because the spinal cord injury happened in my lower brain, in the brainstem. The breathing and all of those things, the autonomic parasympathetic and sympathetic reactions were all impaired, and they believed it to be a side effect of that.
Mm. You mentioned it's like watching TV without the TV on. What do you mean?
Well, I was just confused. I was just really disoriented, and I was looking up, staring. This is initially when I was in the hospital the first day. I was staring at the TV, but there was nothing on it. Mm. And that was just kind of indicative of how confused and disoriented I was at the time.
Mark Block is with us. He suffered a brain injury 4 years ago, telling us about that experience. As we talk about brain injury and rehabilitation this half hour, if you can join us, perhaps you or someone in your family has suffered from a brain injury, I want to hear from you this hour. A brief talk about your experience, the challenges that you face, as Mark shares his challenges. 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. If you'd like, you can post something on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio or tweet us at IPR Talk. Carla Block with us,
yes.
Mark's wife. So what did you think? This is a very scary experience for you as well.
Oh, yes, definitely. Mark was not actually diagnosed with the brain injury for 2 years after it occurred. So during those 2 years, we kept complaining to doctors that Mark saw about some of the symptoms that he had. But because the spinal cord injury seemed to take precedence over that, there were physical disabilities that he had. The brain injury wasn't actually diagnosed for 2 years, but we just knew something wasn't quite right with Mark. He would have angry outbursts. He's not an angry person per se, but he would get agitated and then angry if something didn't go right, or if the kids would be too loud, he would just lose his temper temporarily and then always be remorseful about it, but just losing that temper. He would be forgetful. This is a man who would never lose anything, never misplace anything, but he would misplace his phone, credit cards, things like that that he would never do. He would forget. We would tell him we were leaving the house, and then he would call and say, "Where did you guys go?" And forget where we had told him we were going. He would have he would tell us he would have kind of double vision, just kind of strange things. And things, I just knew things weren't right. We had had a good marriage, and I felt like our marriage wasn't going well. Just a lot of arguments that I couldn't attribute to anything in particular. And then finally, after 2 years, he was diagnosed with the brain injury, and things made more sense after that.
What was the trigger to finally get that correct diagnosis of the brain injury?
Mark had been going to the Rehab Institute in Chicago for his spinal cord injury, and while he was there, Mark communicates much better in person than on the phone, but we'd had been having many conversations on the phone, and between our conversations on the phone and some friends of his that he had made in Chicago, listening to his conversations, between that and him becoming lost in Chicago, becoming disoriented, which again, he had traveled for a living and never got lost, just some things started adding up, and some friends encouraged him to seek to get consulted at RIC for brain injury. And so he saw a speech-language pathologist there, and they diagnosed him with the brain injury there.
What was that diagnosis like, Mark? A bit of a relief to know, finally?
Well, it was kind of a double-edged sword, and that's a very good question, because to see it in black and white, it was heartbreaking to see the diagnosis and to see the deficits. But yet at the same time, at least we had that acknowledgement that, yes, there is something there, and acknowledging that, no, you're not crazy, or that there is a reason for your things. But to see it in black and white was just sad. My wife and I sat there, and we almost cried. But it was to see it in black and white and to see the deficits, and it was really with mixed emotions.
Mark Block, you are now a volunteer with an organization mm-hmm. called On With Life. Mm-hmm. And this is a nonprofit organization founded by families to specialize in brain injury rehabilitation. Also with you in the studio, Dave Anders. He's a therapy manager at On With Life. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Ben.
And let me start with you, though, Mark. When did On With Life enter the picture for you?
Well, yeah, and further clarification on Carla's point is that the speech-language pathologist at RIC did enough testing to warrant that we had more thorough, what they call neuropsychological evaluation, which then I was referred to the Rehabilitation Institute or the On With Life for outpatient therapy, and we did went through that extensive evaluation, and that teased out more of the specifics, and then I continued to go for 6 months for what they call cognitive therapy, which is developing strategies to manage the brain injury.
Dave Anders, can you tell us a little bit about Mark's case? Tell us the type of therapy, how he was diagnosed from your perspective, and the type of therapy he received, what difference it's made.
Sure. Mark came to us with obviously the fact that he can sit and do this interview is extremely impressive.
What kind of shape was he in when he came to you?
Well, given the type of injury that Mark had, he presented with and continues to present with some cognitive and communication difficulty. And these are the kinds of things that are really the reason why brain injury is sometimes called an invisible injury, because to look at Mark, he can talk, he can walk, he can eat, he can get dressed in the morning, but those subtle cognitive difficulties can cause significant challenges with things like managing a home and maintaining a relationship keeping a job, all of those things, the subtle things like the memory difficulty and right. The high level, what are called executive functions, those reasoning and problem solving and judgment, those are all things that can severely impact someone's function.
So as a therapy manager, what do you do to bring back someone's function as much as possible after such an injury?
Well, really, step one is an accurate diagnosis. So you need to figure out exactly where are these deficits, what types of deficits do you have. And then it's a combination of really doing a lot of brain injury education. And in Mark's case, this was extremely important. For 2 years, you've got someone who's been having these difficulties and isn't sure why, and now we have a reason why.
So helping him understand what his injury is. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean by the education?
Absolutely. Mark, you're having these high level difficulties because you injured the front part of your brain, and that's what's responsible for many of these executive functioning kinds of troubles that you have. So you've got the education piece, and then you have you put into place some, as your previous the gentleman you interviewed earlier talked about, exercises. So we want to hit that part of the brain,
mm-hmm.
and do some exercises, do some tasks that involve using memory and using executive functions. And then really, especially when you look at the fact that Mark still had these difficulties after 2 years, it's therapy becomes much more about compensating, finding compensations to address the difficulties.
Mark Block, what has this therapy done? What difference has it made?
Well, it makes a big difference in that it has taught me some strategies. For example, the importance of keeping an established routine, which is sometimes easier said than done, because with brain injury, no day is the same, and every day presents different challenges. Things that I used to do automatically, like getting dressed, are now, quite challenging, both mentally and physically, that by the time, I brush my teeth and shave and shower, many times I'm just mentally fatigued and worn out. So many times my biggest goal for the day is to get up at a set time and get out of the house. But I keep notes sometimes, which are copious notes, but particularly I have kind of a memory binder I carry with me. So, names of people and things like that I can't compensate or that I have difficulty with because of the memory problems, it helps to make notes.
Teresa is joining us from Cedar Rapids. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. Listening to this conversation, Teresa, has brain injury affected you or a family member?
Yes, me. I have residual brain damage caused from chemotherapy for breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. And how has it affected you mentally?
I knew during the chemotherapy that I had a memory problem, and it's actually very common among breast cancer patients to have some sort of chemo brain, which is what they call it, but mine just got worse and worse over the course of 2 years.
You stopped the chemotherapy?
Oh, yeah. It got worse, and now I'm retired. Before, I was a traveling phlebotomist. I went all over Iowa on my own, drove, went to different screenings, and now I was just evaluated by a neuropsych doctor and came up with a 40% cognitive deficit in my memory.
What does that translate into the terms of everyday challenges that are the biggest hurdles for you?
It's exactly like what your guest said. Every day is different, and it's writing things down. It's trying to get your thoughts organized for what you're going to do during the day. Even, you know, like he said, even getting dressed is very frustrating sometimes because by the time you get dressed, you might have forgotten where it is you're going. Or what it is you're going to be doing. And it affects your relationship with me. It affects it with my husband. He gets a little frustrated when I ask him, you know, three or four times in a row the very same question.
Right. When you meet new people, do you feel, how far do you get into a relationship upon meeting someone before you feel you have to let them know about this? As we said, it's an invisible injury, or do you let them know about that?
Well, if they catch on that I've got a memory problem, if they, you know, hear me ask the same question more than once or twice, and they give me that funny look, I just let them know that I've got a cognitive deficit in my memory. And they, most of them are very understanding. They find it amazing that something that is supposed to cure one illness gives you such trauma with your brain, and it doesn't go away. For me, there's no treatment, there's no medication. I just do exactly what your guest said, and that is come up with very simple, tiny little strategies to get through the day.
Teresa, thank you for joining us and sharing your story from Cedar Rapids.
Thank you.
Mark, does that sound familiar to you? Yeah, it sounds like you have similar challenges.
It does, and a lot of times, you know, I feel pressured, particularly, as Teresa said, when you get that look of people like, you know, I just told you that. And I kind of felt the need early on in my treatment to, you know, forgive me, I have a brain injury. But I don't do that anymore. What I do now is more active listening, where I say, and this is something I learned from my therapist, is that, you know, if I understand what you're saying, this is what you're saying and this is your point. Is that correct? Or sometimes I'll say, you know, this is really important and it's so important. Would you mind writing that down real quick?
Mm-hmm.
That way I won't forget it, or that way, you know, it'll stay top of mind. So those are some more proactive approaches that I've learned. But, you know, as Teresa said, you know, when you're tired and there's a lot of people around, that a lot of times you feel pressure to, you know, acknowledge your disability, but you can't let your disability define who you are. You just have to find some alternatives like that.
Carla Block, we're finishing up the hour. I'm interested in as the spouse of Mark, and of someone with a brain injury, how has it changed your relationship? You said at the beginning you were very worried, weren't you?
Yes. We were just talking about that before we went on air, in fact, and it changes your relationship a lot, but not to the point where it's not something we can get through. We were talking about one of the things we just discussed was the fact that before Mark's injury, we could tease each other. It's just something we did in our marriage. And now after Mark's injury, he's not able to perceive my teasing. His feelings get hurt if I tease him. So we've had to come to an understanding that I don't tease him, or not so much, and he tries, if I do tease him, not to take it personally. So there are things like that that have to be teased out all the time, excuse the pun. And that's just one small thing. There are so many things that with the brain injury, and Mark's is a mild to moderate brain injury, there are just a plethora of things. We've talked about child rearing changes. We've talked about how Mark used to be a disciplinarian with our kids, and now he just doesn't have that ability to be the disciplinarian. I call him a kinder, gentler Mark. Not that he wasn't kind and gentle before, but he just doesn't have that sort of alpha male voice anymore. His affect has changed. His level of affection has changed. There are just a lot of things that are different.
Thank you so much for sharing so much. We could talk longer, but I'm afraid our hour is up. And as we leave this conversation, Mark, it's worth mentioning you're going on RAGBRAI this year. This is your third year, is that right?
I am, and that's my goal. Exercise is very important, but life does go on after injury. And like I said before, you can't let your disability define who you are. So about the time you give in to those limitations, the walls start closing in pretty fast. So I believe that you got to do as much as you can today and use it to do more tomorrow.
Thank you for sharing your story. Dave Anders, very quickly, how can people find out more about this nonprofit, On With Life?
Very simply, you can go to www.onwithlife.org.
Okay, Dave Anders, Mark Block, Carla Block, thank you so much for sharing with us this half hour.
Thank you.
True pleasure, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.